The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here this Monday afternoon. Great program for you. Let me run through the announcements, and then we'll get right to our guest, Dr. Paul Spuda. For those of you who would like to call the show today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as we possibly can. Email, for those of you who prefer using it for one reason or another, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's also our website, and there you will find a very detailed, comprehensive newsletter, which is uploaded to the program Sunday after the Sunday show. It has all of the information on guest bios, the programs for the week in detail, and it's the only place where we have a future events section for Space Show programs. So do check it, because if we have to modify our schedule at any time during the week, this is where we do it first. And if you want to stay current, sometimes we do have to cancel a show, change the time, or do something. So just check it every once in a while to make sure the program you intend to be listening to is actually going to air when you think it's going to air. Also, if you notice that you've tuned into a program and it's not what you think it is, before you get all panicky, check the website newsletter, because that's where I will post updates if the programming has changed. I often can't do it on the email newsletter. And then if you still can't figure out what's going on, please, by all means, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website, off of our blog. And on our blog, you can also comment back and forth to the guest, if the guest is willing to do that, as well as with other listeners. There's a store in the upper left-hand corner, Space Show Gear, of our website. Please do visit it. And then there, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with onegiantleapfoundation.org. And that's how we stay in business and stay on the air. So we appreciate your support, those of you that have supported us, those of you that will support us. Remember, it is a 501c3, so you do get tax deductions both from the federal side as well as the California side. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me. And then podcasting is through gigadial.net and Andrew, and you can find our URL to subscribe to it, the RSS URL, that is, and that's on our website, and both our short-form newsletter that we email out early Monday morning, as well as the website newsletter. If you have any questions about the podcast, please don't hesitate to get a hold of me, including if the questions deal with your smartphone. And let's see, remember, we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they do a lot of different very good things to promote cooperative solutions for space security. You can get a lot more information off of their own website, www.swfound.org. They also help sponsor our webinar series. And that's going to bring me to introducing our guest today, who really needs no introduction at all. Dr. Paul Spuda is back with us. He's a senior staff scientist at the Lunar and Planetary Institute in Houston. His research focuses on impact and volcanic processes on the planets and requirements for sustainable human presence on the moon. He was deputy leader of the science team for Clementine missions to the moon in 1994. God, that sounds like such a long time ago, doesn't it, Paul?
It was a long time ago.
And PI of Minisar and which is a radar experiment with India's Chandrayaan, I'll never get that right,
Chandrayaan mission
in 2008 and 9. Anyway, his bio is up on the website. If you're not a subscriber to his blog, you really should be, because he posts some fabulous articles, and we're going to talk about one of them today, and also a news article that he discovered that and sent to me earlier today. Go visit SPUTUSLunarResources.com, and SPUTUS Lunar Resources is all one word. And again, if you're not a subscriber, you absolutely should be. Paul, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, David. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I'm going to give you a surprise opening question, not what you thought. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
Maybe two-thirds of space show listeners who want to go back to the moon or do something useful in space, more so with humans than what we're doing right now, they claim that all we have to do is wait for the next president, and we will finally have a space policy that will be conducive for doing useful things and going back to the moon. And I would like your take on that, because you've been around, you're experienced, you're knowledgeable. Is waiting for the next president like waiting for Godot, or is there real reason to do that?
Well, there's some truth to it, in the sense that the president sort of sets the general strategic thrust of the space program. NASA is an executive agency, so they take their direction from the White House. They have to report to Congress. They have to get their money from Congress. They have to do what Congress tells them. But at the same time, in terms of implementing that and executing their programs and their mandate, they are a branch of the executive, the executive office of the president. So therefore, if the president is in favor of things like lunar missions, then lunar missions will be much more likely to occur. Conversely, if the president is against such things, they are much less likely to occur. So in that sense, a new president might change the current attitude toward the moon, but it's an insufficient change. I mean, it's necessary but not sufficient. Effectively, you have to have not only the president but also the Congress sign off on a long-term strategic direction. You can't go to the moon in 2 years. You can't go to the moon in 5 years. It's a decade-long project. So you need to get Congress and the presidency aligned with that kind of long-range goal, and that's very, very difficult. Now, having said that, that does not mean it's impossible. Just because it's very difficult doesn't mean it's impossible. And every now and then, circumstances come around and converge such that the president and the Congress do agree. And that happened back in 2004 and in the subsequent two Congresses after that, or actually the subsequent Congresses of the Bush administration. Bush articulated in January of 2004, and that's now 11 years ago, what was called the Vision for Space Exploration, and that was a proposal. It wasn't a statement that this is the way it's going to be. It was a proposed national policy. Congress held hearings on it. They agreed to it. They codified it in two different NASA authorizations. Twice by Congresses under the control of both parties. So it was, in every sense of the word, a multi-branch of government, bipartisan space policy. And that was in place from 2004 until President Obama canceled it in the spring of 2010. So it lasted for 6 years.
Without being partisan, so I'm asking you on both sides of the aisles, do you see any of the talked-about likely candidates from either party that would want to reestablish a Let's Go to the Moon program?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, I have my suspicions and in my educated guesses, but that's all it is. I mean, no one really knows what a president will do until you're dealing with that president in office with the power to make decisions. And their decision power is circumscribed by what their Office of Management and Budget tells them, what their scientific advisors tell them, and what members of their party and members of the Congress tell them. So in order to have that kind of confluence of all those different factors add up to a new program, it's not that easy, and yet it has happened in the past. So I wouldn't say that a new president will get us to the moon. I will say that any new administration, and this is true for any presidential term, any new administration is an opportunity to begin in a new direction. And it's especially likely to happen if it is widely perceived that the current direction or the recent direction has been in the wrong direction. So if there is a sense of the country and of the Congress and of the new administration that the space program has been heading down the wrong path, it is likely to be fixed. It is likely to be changed. Whether that includes the moon as a destination, I don't know. I think there are a lot of good, solid intellectual arguments you can make. And they were made back, 11 years ago when the vision came out, and they will be made again if there is a new when there's a new administration. The value of the moon and what it gives us in terms of creating new capabilities and preparing us to go further into space. That's been discussed and debated ad nauseum, and it's fairly well understood. So the intellectual groundwork, I think, has been laid. Whether a new president would take that direction or not, I just don't have any idea. I don't think anybody can predict.
I'm assuming a return to the moon will be competitive with the asteroid redirect as well as going to Mars or the moons of Mars. Do you have any thoughts on how it might stand up to that kind of competition? Because there's going to be advocates for all of that in a new administration.
Sure. Well, if you want to look at it that way, yeah. I mean, that there's always that argument. Is it moon or Mars, asteroid or moon, asteroid or Phobos? You can lay these out any way you want.
Right.
It's the wrong argument, right? I think the argument ought to be, and this is where I think the recent NRC report made a big mistake, although there are some good things in that report. The argument shouldn't be, well, where do we go, and what should the program be? It should be, how do we, first of all, why do we have human spaceflight? Secondly, if you acknowledge that it has value, what is the way to increase its value, to increase its capability, its reach, and its robustness in terms of political and economic survivability? That should be the question. And so you do that through picking intermediate goals and milestones that not only contribute to the long-term objectives that you might have, but also lay the technological groundwork and legacy infrastructure that allows you to do those long-range goals. So in other words, instead of thinking about, well, do I do a dash to an asteroid, or do I do Apollo back to the moon, or do I do a crash program Apollo to Mars, which effectively was sort of what the ESAS was. It was Apollo to Mars. Or do I incrementally and systematically and continuously expand my reach outward from LEO to first cislunar space, then to the moon, then to the asteroids, and then to Mars, and then beyond? And I, to my mind, I've always argued, and this is what I've been beating the Bible about for the last 20 years, that you really need to think in terms of a incremental small step program, because that not only builds that long term capability and infrastructure I was talking about, but it's also, you can tailor it to be affordable, and you can also use it to set intermediate milestones that give you the political payback that allows you to sustain it.
Okay, so I mean, that's a big nut to ask the American people to understand, let alone Congress to understand, and all of the players that make policy.
I don't think so. I mean, you don't keep from them what your goals are. I mean, ultimately, our goal is to be able to go anywhere we want in space. Okay,
correct.
We want to go to the moon. We want to go to the asteroids. We want to go to Mars. We want to go to Jupiter. We want to go to Venus. For all I know, we want to go anywhere in the solar system to do whatever job we can imagine. And so, what you want to do is to lay out the logical case that you can do this if you follow some kind of a systematic incremental plan that builds capability upon itself, that you get one capability, you don't abandon it and then go pursue the next stunt. You basically build on your existing capability. So in a way, that was sort of the argument of the old von Braun architecture of the 1950s. And you remember he had his four-step program, and it was first rocket to LEO, and then space station, and then moon tug, and then interplanetary spacecraft. And each step laid the groundwork for the next step, and each next step basically moved humanity further out into space. And you didn't abandon the steps as after you created them, right? Because you needed them. You needed the Earth to Leo. You needed the space station. You needed the moon tug, and you needed the Mars mission. You needed the interplanetary vehicle. So all these things were part of an incremental system. Now, that was a darn good approach. It made logical sense. And it was abandoned for Apollo for the simple reason that there was a political imperative to beat the Soviets to the moon. And so, therefore, we went directly, we basically skipped reusable spacecraft, and we skipped station, and we went directly to the moon, primarily to beat the Russians there, which we did. And then once that was done, with that goal accomplished, or that political goal accomplished, there was no rationale to continue the program. The incrementalism idea had been totally lost. So they went back to square one, and the shuttle was originally planned to be that kind of system. The shuttle's official name was Space Transportation System, and that meant not doing space lab missions or just building the station. It was going to do that and much more. It was a transportation system that was the first part of a system that would allow us to access anywhere in space, not just Earth to Leo. Earth to Leo was the first step. So if you might recall, back in the 80s, when President Reagan announced space station, the space station project, it was called Space Station Freedom. And part of Freedom was to serve as a staging node for trips beyond Leo. So it was a staging marshalling area for equipment to send beyond low Earth orbit. But also there was a part of Freedom called the OTV, the Orbital Transfer Vehicle. And that was designed, that was a reusable orbital vehicle that was designed to take payloads up to and from geosynchronous orbit, because that was sort of the pay zone, right? That's where the commsats are and the remote sensing and the weather satellites.
Right.
And it was realized by two guys down at NASA JSC, Wendell Mandel and Mike Duke, that in fact, if you could go to geo, you could go to lunar orbit, because energetically they're identical. And their basic calculus was, well, if it can be done, someone will want to do it for some reason. And that was what really kicked off the movement to understand lunar return, the lunar base movement, which sort of started in the early 80s, 83, and then essentially carried on until 1989, when the next president, George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, announced what was called the Human Exploration Initiative and the Space Exploration Initiative. And that was announced on the 20th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. And that the idea there was to implement this idea, implement lunar return by doing this incremental approach. Now, what happened after that is kind of interesting. When the plans were submitted for cost analysis, there were multiple margins built in. Things were multiplied by factors of 5 and 6 for no good reason, and they presented a bill that said this is going to take $600 billion or in 30 years. And everybody had a heart attack. All right, that number was broadcast all over there wasn't a blogosphere then, but there certainly was a space media. And that number got a lot of currency, even though there's a lot to be said about it's basically a bogus number, because it included a lot of cost margins, a lot of anticipated overruns. It was an inflated number. But anyway, the problem was that cost made everyone choke, and that pretty much put the kibosh on the SEI. Now, that didn't kill the lunar base movement. I mean, that was still around. But then in the 90s, it started competing with the idea of, well, we've been to the moon, so let's just forget about that and go direct to Mars, because Mars is where the action is. And so there developed a rivalry. And it's not really a war, but it's definitely a competition between the lunar advocates and the Mars advocates, and that is with us till the present day. And that actually affected the way the VSE was implemented too. But the net effect is you're always going to have this tension when you say I'm going to limit the budget of the agency to a certain amount, or you can't do everything, so you have to choose. And if you have to choose, what do you do first? And that's the source of the conflict, such as it is among space advocates.
Well, of course, you're never going to see an unlimited budget for just let's do everything and we don't have any constraints at all. That's not going to ever happen.
That's absolutely right. So you've got to choose, and that's why I think doing this sort of incremental continuous approach is much better because effectively, whether you make fast progress or slow progress, it doesn't matter. You're making progress. So every year, you're closer to the goal of being able to go anywhere and do anything.
So going back to my opening question before we go into really why you're on the show, is if you were going to assess the probabilities of a next president being able to lead us to the moon, given who seems to be in the playing field of both parties today, I'm not asking you to name names, but what would you assess the probability of that?
Oh, I'd say better than even money. Better than 50-50. I think it makes too much logical and programmatic sense not to include the moon in a path outward from Leo. So I will assume that any new president will support to some extent a human space program, because they always have. I further assume that they will see that our current path is not particularly satisfying because we haven't really done anything in the past 10 years. We've continued to operate station. We're just now getting the Orion ready for flight. We haven't flown the SLS yet. So we haven't flown a new heavy lift vehicle. The shuttle's gone. And so the real question is, well, what are we going to do for the time horizon after the station is retired, after that mission is completed? And I think when you compare all the options of what you could do and what legacy and knowledge they yield, and infrastructure they provide, I think returning to the moon comes up very favorably in that kind of analysis. So I think we actually have a better than even chance of getting lunar return back on the plate. The other thing to consider that people overlook is that our international partners are going to the moon, whether we go or not. So the question is, do we want to be a part of that, or are we just going to stand back and watch them do it? And I think that's a problematical question. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I know what my answer would be. But I think that eventually there will be pressure on the current American leadership to say, look, these guys are going to the moon. Why aren't we there? You know, why aren't we being a part of this?
One final question on this line of thinking, and I'm curious for your answer, because at a time when the middle class is being wiped out and more people are out of the job market than since the Great Depression, and despite some economic numbers that, you know, there's not a recovery for everybody, and people are really hurting, healthcare is, you know, I could list a litany of whatever. The only bright side is low energy prices for the time being. Is human space flight, you know, worth the billions that we need to spend on it to go beyond Leo with people?
You're going to get a different answer to that depending on who you ask.
Well, yeah, I want to know your answer. I want to know how you answer.
Well, my answer is, of course it is.
Yeah, but I want to hear how you respond to that.
Well, first of all, it's not the fraction of the budget everyone thinks. That my first response is, well, what do you think an overfunding amount would look like as a fraction of the federal budget? And usually you'll get something like, well, if you're spending a third of the budget or a quarter of the budget. And most people I talk to who are not in the space business are stunned when I tell them that the current budget is less than a third of 1% of the federal budget. So putting that in perspective, I don't think it's a lot of money. I also don't think we're spending enough on it. But it's really not a question of how much do you want to spend. It's a question of how smart are you in spending it. Can you spend the money in such a way that you create a capability that allows you to do useful, societally useful things? And the record of NASA on that has been pretty good. We have built spacecraft that have done incredible things. It has created both a technological base and a capability base that has national security and national economic ramifications. So my argument is that human spaceflight is a relatively inexpensive luxury, if you will, compared to a lot of what the federal government spends its money on. And I certainly claim that we get much more value from it than we do from a lot of other things.
Turning to why I asked you to come back on the show at this time is, on January 3rd, you posted one of your blog articles that really got to me, overthrowing, in quotes, science. because I think you nailed things right on the head. Tell us about it.
Okay. This actually was inspired. I've been watching movies. I was watching movies over the holiday weeks, and I saw two movies that really kind of struck me. I thought they were quite interesting. The first one was a movie that was actually a few years old. It was made back in the about 10 years ago, and it was called Einstein and Eddington. It was a BBC movie that described the expedition, the British expedition, the 1919 British expedition to observe the total solar eclipse. And it was led by Sir Arthur Eddington, who was an astronomer at Cambridge. And he made that expedition primarily to test general relativity. And the idea was that by taking a photograph of the star field behind the sun during the moments of totality and measuring the position of those stars and then looking at the same star field without the sun there, the stars that are near the sun should be displaced because Einstein's general relativity predicts that light will be bent by gravity. And and it predicts a very specific amount of bending. And so when those plates were compared, the stars were displaced by exactly the amount that the general theory predicted. And thus relativity was sort of verified experimentally. And I put that in big quotes because what I found interesting about this was that the way the movie treated that event as a scientific historical event, it basically implied that this was the overthrow of Newtonian mechanics. And you will often see this in books that talk about relativity and how it was developed and why people worried about it. You'll hear that, well, it overthrew the Newtonian worldview. And I think that was the wrong word. I don't think overthrowing is correct. And that got me to thinking about how science is done and how it ought to be done and how it's done now. And so those are sort of that's a broad overview of what got me thinking about this. The interesting thing is that Newtonian mechanics describe the universe pretty darn well. And in fact, within the realm of human experience, and that is the masses we deal with on a daily basis and the velocities we travel, there is no need for relativity at all. Relativity basically describes things at the extremely small end and the extremely large end of the scale in terms of distance and masses and velocities. And so, and the interesting thing is, when you look at at Einstein's general equation of gravitation, it actually reduces to Newton's gravitational equation for normal ranges of masses and velocities. So it there wasn't any overthrowing at all. What relativity was an expansion of the previous worldview into realms where men had very little experience of measurement and knowledge. So it was an extension of Newtonian mechanics. It wasn't an overthrowing of it. And then that got me to thinking a bit about how we view scientific progress in general. There are very few revolutions in science. A revolution is when you have a completely different worldview overtake a previous worldview. And a classic example of that is the Copernican Revolution, where effectively we changed our view of the universe from an Earth-centric one to a non-Earth-centric one. And Copernicus said that the planets orbit the sun, and Ptolemy said that, no, the sun and the planets orbit the Earth. Now, that's a fairly stark difference. Both of them can't be right. One is right and the other is wrong. And so when the Copernican model, which actually, by the way, was not quite right, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute, the Copernican model was verified as that the Earth is not at the center of the solar system, then that was a revolution because effectively the old order was overthrown. It was completely thrown out. And that is not what happened in the case of relativity and gravitation. Now, what I mean by the Copernican model being not quite right was Copernicus said the planets orbit around the sun in a circular orbit, including the Earth, and that's not true. And what Kepler found, who came after Copernicus, was that the paths of the planets around the sun are elliptical. And that was critical. That was a critical insight for Newton to develop his theory of gravitation, because only the inverse square law explains that relationship. Kepler's second law about the amount, the equal areas being swept out in the same times. So that effectively was the modification needed to complete the Copernican revolution. We credit Copernicus because he was the first one that had the guts to actually put it in print, and although he did wait till he died. So I guess he wasn't totally crazy. Galileo, of course, published his work when he was alive and faced the Inquisition for it. But anyway, I highly recommend this movie, The Einstein and Eddington. It's well worth watching. Interestingly enough, you can watch it for nothing on YouTube. I put the link in my blog post, so you can watch it. It's about 2 hours long, and it delves into the personal lives of both these guys, and it was really quite fascinating. But I thought that as a history lesson for teaching people how science is done, it was a little bit simplistic. And that brings me to the second movie that I discuss in the blog post, and that was the movie that's currently in the theaters now called The Imitation Game, which is the story of Professor Alan Turing's role in cracking the Enigma code. And this was a coding machine that the Germans had developed before World War II, and they actually developed it for commercial traffic, because commercial traffic is confidential and there's industrial spying. So they developed this machine that could encode messages such that it would be virtually impossible to decode them. It used a series of gears and wheels that had different detents or settings that unless you had the decrypt code, all you would get is gibberish when you tried to decode these messages. And there were tens of millions of possible combinations of Enigma, so it was effectively considered uncrackable. Well, two things happened that allowed the British to crack Enigma. One was that the Poles escaped to Britain when Hitler invaded in September 1939. They escaped with a couple of Enigma machines. And so the British had machines of the type that the Germans were using to code their military traffic. And that was a big advance because they were able to study Enigma and understand how it worked. But then the problem became, how do we break this code? How do we figure out of the tens of millions of combinations the right ones in a relatively short period of time? And that was the key thing. It wasn't that you couldn't crack them. You couldn't figure out what the codes were. It's just it took too long. And the codes were changed every day, so the Germans had a way to make their communications unreadable. Well, Turing was a mathematician who had thought a lot about computable numbers, and he had developed what he called a Turing machine that allowed you to compute any computable number he claimed could be calculated using a machine, which was quite an amazing insight. And people tend to, nowadays we don't even think twice about such a notion, but that was quite radical in his day. And Turing basically was dealing with this. He built a machine with tumblers and relays that allowed him to input the encrypted messages and come to a solution. And the problem was it was going on too long because they didn't have they were trying every possible combination. And when you try every possible combination, it takes forever. I was reminded of the scene in Dr. Strangelove where they're trying to recall the bombers that are headed to Russia and. There was a code, a recall code, and there were enough permutations that the bombers were going to hit in 30 minutes, and they would have to take 72 hours to go through all the possible codes. And that was the same problem the British faced in World War II. So what Turing had an insight, he had a flash of insight, that in fact, every day, the first message that the Wehrmacht headquarters sent to its field officers was a weather report. And the weather report always ended with the words, Heil Hitler. And he was having some beer with his friends, and suddenly that struck him. He says, wait a minute, if the weather report includes this word in every single day, then we have a key to, we don't have to look at every combination, we can narrow that down. And so he developed an algorithm to allow them to do that. And that allowed the British to crack the Enigma. Instead of tens of hours of computation, they did it in a few tens of minutes. And that was the big breakthrough. And it was it's a very good movie. I highly recommend it to everyone. It's quite enjoyable. But again, what struck me at this one was at the end of the movie, they have a little flash on the screen, and they say that nowadays we call Turing's machine a computer. And that statement implied that Turing invented the computer. And that simply isn't true. We've had computers for many years. They actually started back in the ancient times, And there were medieval attempts to build calculating machines, and of course there was Babbage's famous calculation machine in the 19th century. And all these things were steps toward a path of understanding what was needed to build a machine that could compute, that could add, subtract, multiply, and divide. And actually, the guy I would give most credit for building the computer was John von Neumann, who was one of the Manhattan atomic scientists who came up with the basic architecture of a central processing unit and storage registers that you would have data, you would compile data, you would run them through the CPU, and you'd store the results. And that simple serial architecture is basically how a computer works. Every computer we have today uses that kind of architecture. And so that was much more of a breakthrough. That was first applied in machine form into ENIAC, which was the first electronic computer that was built right after World War II. And it was actually built to help them solve the problem of how much mass you needed to make a fissionable bomb. And ENIAC could calculate that amount. And I was struck by the movie's ability to kind of change the terms of the history of science. But then I got to thinking about, well, what does this mean about how we think about science in general? And that's sort of what I discussed in the rest of the blog post. And I noted, you know, a lot of science today is very much, there's not as much thinking about things, I think, as there used to be. Scientists generally job is to explain nature, and their task is made easy because we can observe things that inform our speculations. So if I observe something like Newton observed the apple falling out of a tree, and he said, well, what if this force that's making this apple fall to the ground is the same one that keeps the moon in its orbit? And that is literally how he began thinking about the gravitational problem. And ultimately, he came up with the law of gravitation. And it's that kind of observation and deduction or induction, where you look at some general things that happen and try to figure out, you look at a variety of different things that happen and try to figure out a general explanation, or you see a specific thing and you try to deduce backward from that what happened. And there's sort of two different approaches. But all science should follow the model of observation, hypothesis, and then experimental testing. And once you've done that, if your hypothesis stands, I mean, if your idea, and usually it starts out as an educated guess, if it survives experimental tests, then it becomes generally accepted. And a hypothesis that can stand up to any test we can imagine is granted with the honorific of theory. Okay, so people, I think, in who are not scientists, misuse the word theory. They use theory to mean, well, it's my theory that such and such is true. Well, they really mean it's my opinion that such and such is true. Theory has a much more weighty position in science. It's basically a body of knowledge against which many tests have been applied, and this concept has survived all of them. And so that's why we talk about the theory of gravitation and the theory of evolution, all right? We talk about those two things because they were originally hypotheses. We've tried to test them to the extent that we can, and they've stood up to every test that we can imagine. And therefore, that's our, we accept that as theory, meaning that it's scientific truth, and I put that in big quotes.
So, how do you go from theory to fact?
Well, facts come before theories, right? Facts come before hypotheses. Okay, a fact is an apple falls to the ground. All right, a fact is that a bird can fly. Right, a fact is that the moon goes around the Earth. Those are facts. The hypothesis is next. That is the wild idea that a scientist or someone has of why things work the way they do. Okay, let me say, well, I think that the apple falls and the moon orbits because it's held by some invisible force, and I want to describe how that force works. And Newton looked at all the properties of the moon, and he looked at the properties of falling bodies, and he concluded that there was a good description of that was dependent on the masses of the two objects, their distance, and it was dependent on the square of the distance. So it was the inverse square law. And basically all that means is that if I have an object that's two times further away than another object, then its gravitational attraction is one-fourth. It's the inverse square, okay? And so that moved to the hypothesis of universal gravitation, and then subsequently to his publication of that, that was tested by other scientists who applied it to other situations, and it was found to give good answers. So then it moved from the zone of hypothesis to theory. So we go from facts and to maybe there's an intermediate step, call it conjecture or guess. Facts, conjecture, hypothesis, and theory. And then the last stage, if a theory has been around for years and years and years and people accept it, all the scientists accept it, it becomes what's called the law. And certainly gravitation was a law. And one of the reasons relativity made such a big splash was at the time Einstein lived, gravitation was considered to be a law. It was, as we say, settled science, okay? It was science that everyone agreed on. It passed every test we could possibly imagine. Oh, but wait a minute. There were a couple of tests it couldn't quite explain. What is that? What was that? Well, one was the orbit of Mercury, where the perihelion of the planet, the argument of perihelion, which is the lowest, the closest approach to the sun, it shifts as the planet orbits around the sun. And that amount of shift was not the same predicted by the Newtonian theory of gravitation. And that was a puzzle. Nobody understood that. And then, of course, the other thing was the idea of the bending of light. Could light be deflected by gravitational force? And so Einstein worried about that, and that's why he developed general relativity, because it was the zone at which Newtonian mechanics broke down. And what he found was that for the very massive things, that in fact that there really isn't anything as space and time. There's only one thing, and he called it space-time, and it is curved. It's three dimensionals, but it's curved and it's warped by the presence of big, massive objects like the sun or like a black hole. And when space is warped, things don't go in a straight line; they go in a curved line. And that effectively was what relativity did. So it overthrew the law, but we don't call it the law of relativity. We call it relativity theory or general relativity. So there's a law that had been well established for 200 years. Newton's work came out in the 1660s, and his gravitational law was pretty well established for the next 200 years. But by the end of the 19th century, it was starting to look a little bit creaky around the edges. And what Einstein did was to extend it and modify it to those very, very large realms. And now we're back to the theory. So it's not a law anymore. It's a theory.
And so usually quite a bit has to go between theory to law, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are very few laws in science. There's the law of thermodynamics, and there's the law of gravitation. But there aren't very many laws. We try to keep laws to a minimum because, for one thing, the word law in science applies that it's universal applicability. And that's we're not sure about that because we haven't seen all situations. So although we suspect that, for example, the laws of motion and mechanics are the same here as they are anywhere in the universe, we're not positive. And, in the last 50 years or so, when we started thinking about really weird objects, like supermassive objects, like neutron stars and black holes, and then you start getting into some really bizarre behavior of matter and energy. And that's been used, as a springboard for a lot of science fiction movies, the latest being, of course, Interstellar, which I happen to like a lot. I thought that was a great movie.
So the laws of physics is obviously a misused statement most of the time we hear it, I would then say.
I think it is, you're still going to hear it because it's in common usage, and it's been used for a long time. I'm very careful about what I consider to be totally, completely, and fully understood. My sense is that the vast bulk of science is only temporary interim knowledge until we have better measurements and better observations of different things.
So let's go back to your article. You got the idea of this because of these two movies.
Right.
So for those who haven't read this yet, what are you suggesting? How are you linking the movies to reality?
Well, in just two points on that. One is I wanted to caution people who see movies about science to be careful about what they take away from those, because I think that in broad terms, and this is true of history as well, when you combine history and science in the movie business, remember, you're writing dramas, and dramas have to engage the audience and tell a story. And so sometimes they simplify stories. So I think that the image given in these two movies are very much oversimplified. And I just wanted to caution people against that. But the second thing was this other point about, and this actually ties back to what we started with, interestingly enough, is that I contend that science advances incrementally, and that small steps are what virtually all of us do. I mean, I certainly have never written in my lifetime, nor do I think I ever will, something as breathtaking as relativity or evolution or anything like that. We all do small, highly specialized pieces of a much bigger puzzle. And with any luck, we contribute something that's worthwhile, something that lasts. But in fact, you know, the great science of today is the in the trash can of tomorrow, and you can look at that. I mean, look at all the scientific work that was done in the past two centuries. The vast bulk of it is incomplete or in error or just plain wrongly interpreted, wrongly conceived, and wrongly executed. So, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, that's how science advances. We advance just as much by our mistakes and by false results, and as long as we recognize them as such, and that we build an edifice of knowledge incrementally, a brick at a time. And I was struck by how that's changed a little bit when I hear people talking about certain scientific topics. And I had two in my article. The one was the origin of the moon, which is in my field, and that considered by most people in the lunar science field as a settled problem, and I don't think that it is. It's people have, about 10 years ago, no, check that, sorry, make that 30 years ago, because this was in the 1980s. 1984, there was a conference in Hawaii, and it was the Origin of the Moon Conference, and it basically had a bunch of people from a lot of different areas come and give their favorite origin of the moon. And it turned out almost everyone liked the idea of a giant impact on the Earth creating the moon at 4.6 billion years ago. And it became such a popular idea that a bandwagon developed. And pretty soon, every lunar observation and every result was being interpreted through the lens of the giant impact. And I don't think that's the way science ought to work. I don't have any problem with the giant impact as a hypothesis, as a model, but it, as a hypothesis, it needs to be testable. You need to be able to say, okay, if there was a giant impact, A should have happened, B should not have happened. And if you get a result that says A didn't really happen and B might have happened, then what does that tell you about your hypothesis?
It sucks.
Well, or at best, it's incomplete. And so, but that's not the way people were treating the big whack model, the giant impact model. They were basically saying this is a solved problem. And soon, a few years after that, I started seeing things that we knew about the moon for a long time were being ignored because they didn't fit into the new model. And I think I thought that was the worst kind of science I'd seen, where effectively, it's okay to question a preliminary measurement. You might say, okay, well, it wasn't done right, or the observation is misleading, and it doesn't fit into what we expect. But if you constantly get, if you have an unvarnished, undisputable fact, and you constantly get answers that are contrary to the predictions of the model, then your model's not right. And I found that there's an increasing tendency in science to embrace models over observational data. And I guess that's if you wanted to sum up my thing and in my rant in one phrase, that would be it. That I consider observations supreme. Even bad observations are better than the best model, because the models you make are only as good as your input assumptions, and you never know if you've got all the input assumptions correct. And the other thing that I drew attention to in this, besides the origin of the moon, was the idea of human-caused global climate change, which now, if you question your sanity is questioned, your morality is questioned, and I just think it's become effectively a new kind of of religion with people. They want to believe it because they want to believe it. And anything that you, any observation you make has to fit into that kind of model. So I think that's an example. Those are two examples of science that, in my opinion, are not being done correctly. That fundamentally, scientists shouldn't have any preferred model. They should let the facts speak for themselves.
What is the overall effect of this on we, the ordinary folks, through the media, through our high school and even our college classes, when we're not actually studying to be a scientist? We're taking science as a literature major or a history major or something like that. It seems to me that we're kind of being misled and we don't even know it.
That's exactly right, and that, of course, is a great fear. What I fear are people using the prestige and the gravitas of science to bludgeon their ideological opponents into silence. And I think that is a danger. I think we see that a lot. The one thing that scientists are careful about talking about, a lot of scientists don't like to talk about this, and the reason they don't is because all of us get our funding by proposing, and we propose our money for grant money to do our research, and our proposals are reviewed by our peers. And if you're perceived by your peer as a crank, you're not going to get a very good review, and chances are you won't be funded. So people who have controversial opinions or heretical opinions or oddball opinions tend to keep them to themselves. And so a lot of scientists aren't very honest about this. And I think that of all the faults a scientist can have, dishonesty is probably the worst. You've got to be honest. I mean, in every paper I've ever published, I've tried to admit what I don't know and what I don't yet understand. I said, here's what the data are telling me. They could mean something else, but for that to be true, this would have to be the case, and we don't know that. I've always tried to make the case that although I may not fully understand everything about a problem, I admit that I don't understand it, and I admit where my knowledge breaks down. And I'm seeing less and less of that in a lot of the current debates. And, of course, people are using science to make policy choices, and those policy choices affect all of us. And I'm sure, from the medical perspective, I'm sure you could give me an equal number of examples where if it's not outright quackery, but it's something very close to it, where you get people who just join a bandwagon and they bludgeon anyone who disagrees with that interpretation to death.
Well, one of the best ones was a couple of years ago, the argument, I think the drug was Avastin, which is a very, very expensive anti-cancer and other drug, but it did show treatment success with breast cancer. But it was like $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 a month to use it or something like that. So there was a big outcry from the government and insurance companies not to have this classified as a breast cancer. I think it was also a colon cancer drug. So I remember all of the major cancer center doctors came out and said that this was an essential drug, it was helpful and all of that. And they were citing adverse side effects and all that. Of course, the side effects, if you didn't use it, you died.
Yeah.
So you know, let's put adverse side effects into perspective. And they delisted it, if that's the correct word, for the use in cancer treatment. And the science behind that was totally political, manipulated, and bogus. And
right.
You mentioned climate change. I know that's a hot topic on the space show, where half the people will, climb in and say, you're a Neanderthal and, you want to destroy the planet and all of this. But if you read the headlines of the recent announcements about how this is the hottest year ever for 2014 and all of that in the New York Times, the Washington Post, in the mainstream news, you would not know that they're talking about a change in temperature that's within the statistical margin of error and within thousands of a degree. I mean,
right.
This is total crap and nonsense. But if you dug deeper, if you're willing to dig deeper and you know where to dig, you get the truth behind all of this stuff.
Right.
How many people do that?
That's exactly right. And one of the things that in particular in terms of climate, and this also applies to the origin of the moon, too, I deal in my field in lunar science. A lot of people like to use computers and like to make models, and I've even dabbled in that a little myself. I've played with them, And the interesting thing about computer models is that sometimes you make very small changes and they can drastically affect your output. And the problem is when you're dealing with complex nature problems, and that certainly describes geology, which is my field of endeavor. You're dealing with natural systems with many complex variables, some of which you don't even have a clue as to how you can barely guess at, let alone know how to input them. And the problem is that all of these predictions for things like giant impacts hitting the Earth or the climate in 100 years are dependent on computer models. And these models have a very poor record of reproducing reality where we apply them to natural systems where we do have control. For example, the systems that compute large impacts have been applied to large impacts on the Earth, and they fit them okay, but not great. Some answers are way off, and no matter how you can tweak it a little bit and get whatever answer you want. And when you're doing that, when you're changing input variables slightly and getting drastically different output answers, that tells me that fundamentally your model is not very valuable.
So here's a $64,000 question to you. You go to school and you get the headline news. You know, you're not going to get what's behind it and in deep. So how does anyone from a student, let's just say high school and beyond, college, as well as the rest of us, how do we protect ourselves against this? What can we do that's reasonable to not be manipulated by the media and by people with these agendas and by this misleading information? It happens across the board. It's not just with health and climate, but it's with so many other things that are being told to us.
No, that's true, and that's a problem. And it's hard, you know, in highly technical subjects to know who to believe, all right? You're not an expert in certain fields, so you want to understand a problem, and the first thing you do is you go to the internet and you do a Google search and you say, well, let me read this, let me read that, and a lot of what comes up in a Google search will tend to have a certain perspective depending on which way the current literature trend has been. Okay, because what Google does is they basically they arrange their search results in order of things that are most popular and have been hit upon the most times. So you're not necessarily reading an unbiased selection. You're reading what most people have stumbled on. So that's a problem, and you don't necessarily know in a field that's not your own who to believe. But all I can say is that the first rule is to be skeptical of all claims. And I think that's a darn good rule in science and in life in general. Is when someone tells you that X is going to happen or Y is going to happen, demand that they justify why that's true, and you know, ask them for their sources, ask them for their results. Now you won't. That's not a foolproof solution, but it certainly is a good first step. And I would, you know, when anyone tells you, and that includes even things that I believe in. Okay, I mean, I'm not saying this just applies to things that I'm skeptical of. I think you should be skeptical of most claims, because most of the people who make claims have some kind of agenda they're selling. In some cases, the agenda is good and is beneficial, and in other cases, it may not be true. But in any event, you should be skeptical from the outset. And then the second thing is to use that skepticism to systematically find out what the arguments are for it, pro and con. And this is where I think the internet is really valuable, because you know, you can lay your hands on a variety of articles, pro and con, on almost any issue by careful and judicious use of the internet. So it's not a foolproof thing. You know, there's a lot of nonsense on the internet as well as a lot of good stuff. And without a filter, you're going to be somewhat lost. But I think the more you dig into it, the better off you'll be.
What about challenging teachers? Have you had any experience with that?
Well, you know, look, I'm 60, what is it this year? I'm 62 years old now. And when I was in school, you could challenge your teacher if you wanted to. I mean, if you heard something you thought was wrong, or you thought that was factually incorrect, or even if you thought was more an opinion than a fact, then I remember having lots of discussions with my teachers, and they encouraged it. They didn't fear it, and they weren't afraid of it, and they were happy to tell me when I was wrong to sit down and shut up. So, but even when that happened, I was glad that I asked the question, because at least I understood where they were coming from. I understood why they said what they said. And so I think you should challenge your teachers. A good teacher will not be offended by being asked a question or being challenged in a viewpoint. They will say, well, here's why I believe this, and this is the decision train that led me to this conclusion. I think a good teacher welcomes that kind of exchange. I know I do.
What kind of reaction did you get to your article?
Pretty favorable. I mean, most people who come to my blog liked it. I had a few negative comments, and people tend to have very strong opinions on certain topics, and this whole idea of climate change is one. And I am loath to get into it myself, because it really is a no-win situation. The people that are firm believers in it, it's like arguing someone's religion with them. I mean, they're not going to change their minds, and they're going to despise you for questioning their viewpoint. And so I just try not to talk to people about that. And in large part, I successfully avoided it. I thought long and hard about putting that reference into this article, but it just seemed to fit so well at that point that I had to use it. And the interesting thing on that is, if you go to the blog post where I bring that up, and it's at the very end of the article, the second to last paragraph, I linked it to one of my favorite pieces by Michael Crichton, who is the author, the late author of Jurassic Park, among many other things. He gave a speech at Caltech about 15 years ago, and it was called Aliens Cause Global Warming. And it's a really fascinating and interesting speech. And people, a lot of people discounted this piece. They say, well, Crichton, he's just an author of novels. What does he know? Well, in actual fact, he was an MD who actually did biomedical research. He knows science. He knows how science works. And he is a fairly knowledgeable and insightful guy. And in fact, what I really liked about that article was not so much about the climate change, which he talks about at length, but in fact, he took a swipe at SETI at the very beginning of it. That's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Right.
And Crichton claims that SETI is a religion. It's not science. And his argument is that the so-called Drake equation, which is supposedly the intellectual underpinning of SETI, that there should be billions of intelligent worlds out there transmitting to us. He says that fundamentally it's pseudoscience, because it takes the appearance of a mathematical formula, but in fact every variable in it is totally unknown. That effectively you just have to guess. And in order to give you the answer that you want, or the answer that Carl Sagan liked to popularize, his billions and billions, you have to make some pretty wild assumptions. And so he was basically saying the whole idea of SETI was ridiculous because there's no evidence for it. In a way, he was recapitulating Enrico Fermi's question, which back right after the atomic bomb, they were having a discussion about extraterrestrial intelligence at Los Alamos, and Fermi said, well, where are they? He says, if there are millions of worlds and they're filled with intelligent beings, where are they? And, of course, the answer is they're not there, and he interpreted that to mean, well, there's no evidence that they exist. Now, of course, there are a lot of other ways to interpret that observation, too, but Crichton was basically saying that SETI, as an attempt to explain that, is not particularly convincing. And I thought he had a really good, well-developed argument against that. So I really enjoyed that piece.
We're a little more than halfway, so let's take a pause, and when I come back, I want to discuss the other article you sent me, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
So everybody sit tight. We'll be back with Dr. Spuda, and I will start taking some of your emails, which I've been sitting on for the past hour or so during the next segment. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. Part two is now underway of our Monday Space Show program. Paul Spoutis is with us today. And, Paul, you sent me an article a little bit before the show started today from The Verge, T-H-E, Verge, V-E-R-G-E, all one word, .com. And you guys can find it. I'm not going to put it up on the website. But it's titled, Is NASA's Asteroid Mission the Agency's Political Downfall? So, first of all, what do you think of the asteroid redirect mission? Do you think it's a worthy mission to undertake? Is it going to do all that it's supposed to do? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, it's kind of hard to say whether it's going to do all it's supposed to do because NASA hasn't really said what it's supposed to do. They basically outlined this in broad brush. It was based on something that came out of a summer workshop at Caltech a few years ago. And the idea was to use solar electric to haul a small near-Earth asteroid back into Earth-Moon space, and this is lunar, and where it could be studied up close. And I think it has kind of an interesting history. It wasn't originally part of the plan. It certainly wasn't proposed by Augustine. The Augustine Committee in 2009, their report, which President Obama commissioned, wanted something called the Flexible Path, which included possible crewed human missions to a near-Earth asteroid. And that kind of got the ball started on getting NASA thinking about asteroids, because the moon was out. We were going to have a long time between now and the first Mars trip, and they needed something to do. They needed some place to go. And so the thought was, well, we can send this spacecraft on a long-duration, multi-month mission, rendezvous with a near-Earth asteroid, study it up close, and then return to the Earth. And that'll give us deep space experience. It'll allow us to go somewhere we've never been before, and it'll advance asteroid science. And they started adding all these secondary benefits, and some of them are just totally bogus. Like, we would go to the asteroid, we'd learn how to deflect it from hitting the Earth. And that's just a flat-out falsehood. One human visit of a few days to a NEO is not going to give you the knowledge you need to deflect an asteroid. It may give you a piece of information that might ultimately someday be helpful in such a task, but it has nothing to do with that. But the real problem developed when people at JPL and JSC started looking at the known NEOs, and there were a lot of constraints on a human mission that little robotic missions don't have. For one thing, when you rendezvous with the asteroid, you have to come back. Okay, with a robot, you don't care if it goes away and you never hear from it again, but people like to come home. So it had to be a round trip. So that narrowed the list greatly. It had to be pretty much within the plane, the ecliptic plane, because there wasn't enough delta V to get a great deal of distance out of the ecliptic. And so that, again, limited the number of asteroids. The asteroid had to be within in an orbit such that you could go to it and from it within a year or less, and the less the better. because effectively you're talking about going in a very small spacecraft. The Orion has the volume of a walk-in closet, and so you don't want to put the crew into this condition where they're living, you know, they're ready to kill each other after the first couple of weeks. And finally, you have to be a relatively slow spinner so that the spacecraft could approach it and actually interact with it. Most asteroids, a lot of asteroids, spin very fast. And in fact, some of them spin much faster than would be safe to approach with a human spacecraft. All right, so all these things rolled up into a very... And finally, there's one more constraint that nobody talked about very much. And that is we had to have asteroids where we would have enough fuel to abort the mission in case that became necessary. So you're on your way to the asteroid. You have some major system.
Listeners, Paul is back with us. So we were talking about another constraint seldom talked about, which was having enough fuel to abort the mission, and then our phone call was aborted.
Right, and I was just making the point that the last constraint for a NEO mission was the ability to get home in a hurry in case you had to. And that could include things like a major systems failure or some other issue that might arise where you had to get home in a hurry. You had to be able to have enough fuel to turn around and head back to Earth as soon as you could and intercept back to the Earth. So when you rolled up all those requirements, it turned out that there were very few NEOs available. And, in fact, I've heard different stories on this. People were telling me there were 12 NEOs that they could visit, and actually, when push came to shove, there wasn't any. And they started looking for smaller and smaller objects. The original plan was to go to a multi-kilometer sized NEO, and then they started looking sub-kilometer. So they were getting down to the really small ones. So the real problem developed that here we had the president say, well, we'll go to an asteroid instead of the moon. And there were no suitable targets available. So we had a mission, but we had no place to go. And so then the Keck study came along, and the Keck study said, well, we can haul an asteroid and bring it back to Cislunar and then study it there. When I first heard that idea, I couldn't believe they were serious. And I thought, this is somebody who's smoking dope or something. This is the nuttiest thing I've ever heard in my life. I got the report and I read it, and it was something that was barely possible, but yet I saw a lot of problems in it that they hadn't really addressed in this. So it was really sort of blue sky thinking. And I mean, it was amusing as a product of a summer study. I don't disparage it for what it originally was. Somehow, that got sold to the White House as the way to do the asteroid mission. So, in a classic case of the mountain coming to Muhammad, they decided to bring the asteroid back to Earth Moon space and study it there because we could go to Earth Moon space. So we couldn't go to an asteroid. Well, right off the bat, that was one of the big advantages of the asteroid mission over the lunar mission was lost, and that was the idea of long-duration space flight. You could test your systems in deep space over many weeks of space travel. That was gone now. So now we're going to bag this asteroid and bring it back to lunar orbit and study it. And every study that's been conducted on the ARM since then, it becomes less capable and less interesting with each iteration. And now, fundamentally, they're talking. I actually heard the statement at a recent, I saw it from some NASA official, that it doesn't even matter if they get the asteroid now. As long as they get a solar electric stage attached to a rock and they move it, it doesn't matter if they get it back to the Earth or not, which is kind of an interesting attitude, considering that then Orion will really have no place to go. So this thing was conceived poorly. It was adopted without serious thought or debate, and in terms of the science is going to return, it's pretty worthless. If you were able to do what they say you're going to do, you're going to bring an asteroid back, you're going to put it in lunar orbit, you're going to go up to it with an Orion, and you're going to collect samples from it, what have you got after that? You've got maybe 100 pounds of meteorite, and there are already tons of meteorite samples in the museums and private collections of the world. So you're not going to get anything or learn anything that you don't already know from stuff that we've already collected that's fallen free from the sky. I mean, anything that falls on the Earth is a near-Earth object, by definition. So the NEOs have been sampled. They've been sampled through the meteorite collection. And, you know, unlike a planet, on a planet, the context of a rock means a lot. Right? If I pick a rock from the Navajo sandstone or from a lava flow in Hawaii, those two contexts inform my interpretation of what the sample's telling me. Now, asteroids are just pieces of mostly chondritic meteorite, which is the leftover material from planetary assembly, and they're all pretty homogeneous. I mean, there are some minor variations, but there's no context in broad terms. All the chondrites are the same, but even worse, the asteroids are rubble piles, and they are the product of multiple collisions and reassemblies and recollisions in the asteroid belt over the history of the solar system. So a sample from a randomized mass of sample that we call an asteroid doesn't really tell you anything about geological processes. It's only the sample that tells you anything about nebular processes, and we already know that from studying the meteorites. So the roll-up of all this is that there's no real value for science, and there's no real value for operational experience by doing this mission, and yet it's still in the plan, and NASA's actively working on it. Now, this article focused on the political aspects of this, and they were setting this up as a big showdown between the administration and Congress, and in this case, the administration, the proxy for the administration is NASA. Remember, we started off talking about NASA as an executive agency. Well, they're leading the charge. They're basically making the case in this that they're the ones that want this mission. But in actual fact, I can tell you that the people that have looked at this and have thought about it aren't that enthused about it. The certainly the astronauts aren't.
Is it at all a stepping stone on the way to Mars?
Only in the sense that it will be a test of the Orion spacecraft beyond LEO. And in those systems, but you'll get that whatever you do beyond LEO. So certainly going to a captured asteroid in lunar orbit doesn't tell you anything about Mars. I mean, there's no question we can rendezvous with it. Is there a question that's a skill to go to Mars? The real issue that it addresses is it gives Orion some place to go. They don't want to send Orion into Sizzler space without it having some place to go to, and this gives it some place to go.
Well, they could send it to the moon.
Well, but that's the object that cannot be named. And in fact, that's really the origin of this whole concept. The idea was, what can we do that's not a mission to the object that cannot be named?
Well, this article is political, but you're sitting there in Texas in the Houston area, and you know you're in the land of Culberson and Ted Cruz and Johnson Space and SpaceX and Brownsville and. Where Blue Origin has its test flight center. And so what's your take on the politics on this? Is this going to be a showdown between the administration and Congress?
It might be, but my sense is that the administration is gradually moving away from this idea. I think they've sort of gotten the message that it's not as brilliant a solution to their dilemma as they originally thought.
Okay, stop. Name the dilemma specifically.
The dilemma being that you had the president announce we're going to an asteroid and then not having a suitable asteroid to go to. Right? And their solution to that dilemma was to bring the asteroid to us.
Okay.
When you get the president to make a statement that you're going to do something, you ought to know that it's possible to do it. Before Kennedy went to the Congress in May of 61, he had Webb and Dryden come to the White House and explain what his options were. And he said, can you guys go to the moon? And they said, yeah, we can. And so he went to Congress and said, well, we're going to the moon. Now, if they had gone to him and said, well, we can't do that, that's not possible, he wouldn't have gone to Congress and announced it. So typically, a president wants to get input first that something is possible. And then announce it, not the other way around. And unfortunately, this was done sort of from shooting from the hip, that it was announced, and then it was found that after they looked at all the NEOs that were available, that none of them were suitable. So it turned out that what was supposedly doable wasn't doable.
So what do you think the future for ARM? Is it going to be kicked down the road to the next administration?
It'll just evaporate into the nothingness from whence it came. Right now, you're going to see a lot of news articles on it. NASA is going to continue to insist that they're going to do it. They're going to study it. They're going to have meetings. They're going to have major decisions. They're going to have architecture studies. They're going to waste a lot of time and effort, and in the end, it will all just fade away to nothing.
And then what happens to Orion and SLS?
Well, now, that's an interesting question, and that is, in fact, the question. And that brings us back to the very first thing you asked me, is what are we going to do with the space program if and when a new administration takes office? And that will be, Orion and SLS will be one of their input parameters to whatever decision they make. So when a president comes in, they don't know anything about the space program. They sense that there's a policy issue, there's a strategy issue. They look around to their advisors and they say, well, what are my options? And one option is, well, we have this spacecraft. And the other option is, well, we have this rocket. And then from that, they'll say, here are some of the things you could do.
Now,
there are a lot of things you could do.
Will they look at SpaceX and the private sector Falcon Heavy rocket and include that in their options?
If those things are working at that time, of course they will.
Okay.
And 2 years from now, I mean, if there is a Falcon Heavy and if there is a Flight of the Dragon, that's going to be fed into the input process as well. So all those things will be laid out. Say, here's what we've got. Here are the capabilities. What do you want to do, Mr. President? And he'll say, okay, bring me my three wise men and go forth and make a study and come back with a recommendation.
How do you get to be one of the wise men?
Well, that's kind of the luck of the draw. it really is a random chance, pretty much.
Are you bucking for that?
No. I'm making my case on my blog. I make it, and when I make public appearances, and I'm testifying to Congress, I want to get that idea in currency. I want that to be one of the options. So what I'm trying to do is to promote that to the extent that I can.
Do you talk to Culver Senator Ted Cruz?
I have talked to several Congress. I knew Culbertson's former space staffer. I was on pretty close terms with him, and I talked to him a couple times. I do not. He has a new staffer for space, and I have not yet met her. And I have talked with Ted Cruz's staffers on one occasion, and I hope to talk to them again soon.
Are they supportive of the ARM, or what? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, in the sense of Congress on the ARM is pretty well described in this news story that I sent you, and that is that mostly they are pretty skeptical. There is no person on the Hill that I'm aware of who is wildly enthusiastic about the ARM. The closest is Senator Nelson, Bill Nelson from Florida, who supports it. He's not wildly enthusiastic about it, but he supports it. But he will now be the ranking member on the Senate Space Subcommittee under Chairman Ted Cruz. So that has influence. All right, if you're a ranking member, you have influence, but you don't have as much influence as the chairman.
As Ted Cruz does.
Yeah, and I do not know exactly what he believes in terms of the ARM. My sense is that he will look at it with a skeptical eye, and he should. So hopefully he will do the right thing.
Well, so the article headline implies the agency's political downfall, but actually, if they got rid of the ARM, it might free up the agency to do some real meaningful things.
That's exactly right, and that's why I think the author of this article has missed the boat. To the extent that NASA is going to strap themselves to the ARM and go down with it, it's a political problem for them. But to the extent they're willing to reshuffle the cards and think about something else, I don't think it impacts them one way or the other. Yes, they will waste a lot of time and money on it, but so what else is new?
Listeners, the author is John Wentz, W-E-N-Z. When I pulled it up, there were 80 comments on it. On the article, so it might be something that you want to go pick up and read. And
most of them pretty inane, like you would expect from an internet piece.
You don't even know that they know what they're talking about.
Well, that's certainly true in the space business.
To say the least. I'm sitting on a couple of emails, and they want to take you back into Paul Spoudis, the traditional guy going to the moon.
Okay.
Are you up for that?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, so you have 1,500,000 questions from Dr. Doug in Southern California, and each email has 653 parts to it.
Okay.
So so obviously I'm exaggerating, but you get the picture. So question number one, I'll try to make this short and sweet. Let's say we were to establish a permanently crude base at a lunar peak of eternal light. We were to have immediate access to volatiles in the type and concentration found by Elcroft, and we were to have access to the regolith and rocks similar to those we collected during the Apollo program. Also, let's say that Governor Moonbeam of California took up residency on the moon. I'm just kidding about that one. Let's say, but I wish he would, let's say that our base was able to recycle the volatiles as something like an efficiency of 85 to 90%. Question one, what elements, if any, would be lacking in, would we be lacking in? Question number two, this assumes you can remember all of this, or if lacking in nothing, which elements might we be the most limiting?
Well, the real answer to his question is that we don't know the answer to that question, because we only have extremely limited data for the poles of the moon and the volatile deposits. We have the Elcroft data, and he asked me to assume that those species and concentrations. If we had Elcroft type volatiles at my lunar outpost, I could make what I need to survive on the moon. And the only things I would need from Earth are the high information density items like computers and equipment. I would not need consumables. I would make those. And I wouldn't be able to make food initially, but I would be able to make it ultimately. So I think that what we learned from the last round of lunar exploration is that the moon has what we need to enable a long-term, and I'm inclined to say permanent, but I'm going to back away from that a little bit. I will say long-term sustained human presence on the moon. We have what we need there to allow that.
And we can deal with radiation and other issues and the dust and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think we can. I don't deny that there are some unresolved issues with those, but certainly in terms of radiation, the solution is to live underground, right? And it's very easy to bury a module. You lay a habitation module in a deep crater, you backfill it with regolith, and you live there.
But you want to do things on the surface and go places, so.
Sure you do, but you don't go out when there's a coronal mass ejection from the sun. And you just accept the background hard radiation from cosmic rays. You have to. It just limits the total exposure you can have. You can still accomplish quite a bit outside.
Okay, now you have another, we're not through with Doug, but another question came in from Doug. Do you think that solar panels alone are sufficient to run a lunar base that has somewhat heavy ice harvesting equipment?
Well, I think so initially. Ultimately, that's a limiting factor. If you're going to actually start utilizing lunar resources to a great degree, and by that I mean getting enough for export, ultimately you're going to want to transition to a more power-rich environment. Initially, you can do it all with solar energy, and in fact, that's what I tried to show in that Space 2011 paper of a few years ago, where we put in our robotic architecture. That was all based on solar arrays that were in place by robotic spacecraft. That's good enough to get you started, and it's good enough to get you into a modest level of production of volatiles. I don't think it's going to be good enough to really make a thriving community on the moon. I think ultimately you're going to want some kind of fission reactor to generate megawatts of energy.
So fission reactor would ultimately be the way to go.
I think so, and there's no reason not to. I mean, you can. It's a technology development that we don't have at the moment, and so that's why I've focused entirely on solar to get started, to kind of bootstrap. But I think ultimately, if you want a significant amount of activity on the moon with a lot of people, you're going to need a much more robust power source.
Bijan is in Sweden. And he wants to know, one, how is development of the Lunar Resource Prospecting Rover advancing?
As far as I know, it's advancing okay. They have a payload. They have a straw man rover design, is my understanding. They do not have a lander. The biggest roadblock initially was that they didn't have a lander for their rover. They need a soft lander to get the thing down on the lunar surface. The Canadians were participating at one point, and they withdrew. They talked to Japan about getting a lander from them, and now my understanding is Japan is backtracking. So they're actually looking at the commercial aspects, a possible buy of a commercial lander as one possibility. But nothing has been decided, and that's the biggest roadblock to Lunar Resource Prospector that I'm aware of. As far as I know, the rover and the experiments and the operational plans are proceeding apace.
The second part of his question is, do lunar ore bodies vary much depending on type of asteroid that created it? Are there Klondike craters, or is this lunar landscape particularly homogeneous for resource utilization purposes?
Well, the moon is not homogeneous. It is heterogeneous on a variety of different scales. And when he mentions asteroid cause resources, I assume he's talking about metals, a la Sudbury, right?
I don't know. He didn't clarify.
Well, in terms of meteoritic deposition, that's a big unknown area. You know, the meteoritic component on the moon is very dispersed, and it's actually present as a cryptic chemical component. It's not really present as individual fragments of meteorites. And the reason for that is that things hit the moon at very, very high speeds, which vaporize them. And so you don't find intact meteorites on the moon, at least not very much. There's a couple of rare examples in the Apollo collections, I believe. But we don't know that there are ore bodies like the Sudbury nickel eruptive in Canada on the moon, although that's certainly possible, because obviously it's happened on the Earth. It might have happened on the moon. A key thing difference between the two is on the Earth you have water, which acts as a nice fluid to transport dissolved material to various places and have it reaccumulate, forming ore bodies. And you don't have that on the moon. So the only way to get an ore body on the moon is via gravity density settling in a magmatic body. And that may happen, but we haven't yet found a good, solid example of it. There are some suggestions in the lunar samples that it might happen, but we don't know where on the moon it occurs.
Okay, Doug sent in yet another question. Do you think that solar panels alone are sufficient to run the lunar base that has somewhat heavy ice harbor? He's already asked that question.
Yeah, and the answer is I don't know what somewhat heavy means. I think you can start with solar, but eventually you want to transition to nuclear.
Carla in Seattle, Washington, is a sedimentary rock found on a celestial body the same as a celestial rock, as a sedimentary rock on Earth?
It depends on what process made it. I would imagine that an Aeolian sandstone on Mars looks like an Aeolian sandstone on the Earth. If you've ever been to Zion National Park, there's a big, beautiful white rock unit that makes cliffs called the Navajo Sandstone.
Right.
And that rock formed in ancient sand dunes, in an ancient sand sea. And that it was formed by wind-blown sand. It's called an Aeolian sandstone. And it looks like there might be things like that on Mars. The question on Mars is, are there water lane sediments? And although the rover teams have claimed they have found evidence for that, I think the jury's still out. I don't know that that's true or not. There might be. There's evidence that we've had standing water on the planet, so there's no reason why you wouldn't have water lane sediments associated with those. So in that sense, some sedimentary rocks on Mars may well be very much analogous to Earth sedimentary rocks. It just depends on what process formed them.
Bill is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, my hometown. And he says, I'm studying geology at the University of Tulsa. Is geology that I'm studying here on Earth and having to do a lot with oil geology and petroleum, how different is that from geology on the moon or Mars or in space? And how hard would it be for me to transition into the space field?
I don't think it would be very hard at all. I mean, geology is geology, and you're absolutely right that the geology of petroleum is not particularly relevant to the planets.
Oh, Christ, we lost you again. Paul, hello, you can hear me, but I guess I lost you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay, you came back. I lost you. So you said petroleum is not particularly relevant to, and then we lost you.
Okay, it's not relevant to planetary science per se, but at the same time, some of the aspects of petroleum geology are relevant. Things like the subsurface structure, things like faults and folds, things like structural traps, and the interaction of rocks with various circulating fluids. Now that will be relevant if we ever get to Mars and we study the geology of Mars, because there will be deep structure, there will be circulating fluids, there will be all these things that occur on Earth. So everything you learn about geology, and actually this is true for any field of geology, the more you learn about it, the better prepared you are to address geologic questions on the planets. You know, when I was studying geology 40 years ago as an undergraduate, I thought that a lot of what I was studying was totally irrelevant to what I wanted to do. I wanted to work on the moon. I wanted to work on the planets. But I have found that I really have used a lot of what I learned in geology and in studying the planets. Some things that I never thought I would that would be relevant are relevant. And so it's just important for you to absorb as much knowledge as you can. And ultimately, you'll find that when you get ready to study the planets, you'll be well prepared.
So on the assumption that people could actually get to Mars and could actually do real drilling, could they adapt Earth drilling tools in petroleum engineering as well as in geology, like electric log analysis and things like that? Would it be relevant to trying to figure out what's in a Martian drill hole?
Some of it will be. Some of it won't be. You've got a real problem with planetary drilling in that terrestrial drilling uses fluids, and the fluid typically is water,
right.
but it needs to be lubricated, because when you cut rock, you know, you generate a lot of heat and a lot of friction, and it's very hard to drill into dry solid rock, or even dry granular material like on the surface, the upper surface of the moon. And so you're going to have that problem to solve. But once you've done it, I mean, things like cuttings from various depths and drill cores, they will be analyzed in a way very similar to the way that they're analyzed here on the Earth. But keep in mind, geologists are always looking for ways where they don't have to drill. Drilling is expensive. It's very expensive. You don't know that you're putting the hole in the right location. What you really seek out as a geologist are natural outcrops, where you can study rocks that are exposed at the surface. And we know those occur on Mars, and we know they occur on the moon. So those are the places we'll give our first attention. And I suspect the only drilling you'll do are for areas where it's absolutely necessary to drill to get that information that you need.
This is another one. So John is in Denver, Colorado, and he says, do you think we are literally moving closer to a time when we will actually have a policy and both a public and a private sector capable of establishing cislunar development, including transportation for commercial development? Are we actually, in your opinion, approaching that time?
Well, I'm not quite sure what he means by that question. In a way, we've already arrived there. I mean, there's nothing right now stopping you from a regulatory point of view of building your own moon colony or your orbiting moon station or anything else you wanted. What's stopping you is the lack of capital and the lack of a market to sell whatever you want to make. So I think that we've begun to do that in the sense that we've already occupied various zones of cislunar for various purposes. So that economic underpinning is already, the groundwork is already being laid. What's missing is this idea of permanence and the idea of routine access to the various locations in cislunar where these assets reside. And that, I think, is what a good incremental goal would be.
Listeners, we're back with Paul. So we were talking about John's Denver question, and you were about to make the point about routine access.
Yeah, I was just saying that that's the only thing that's missing for what I would consider a real development regime, where you're able to access these various locations where you have satellite assets routinely, and to upgrade them, to modify them, to refurbish them, or to build new ones. So that's what I think would be an appropriate goal for the civil space program, is to focus on developing that capability. And certainly, I think we're very close to that.
So we are moving closer to that.
I think so. I think we're partly there already, and we're moving closer on a daily basis.
Tim is in Huntsville, and his question is, there have been proposals for reusable lunar shuttles that would ferry people from lunar orbit to lunar surface and back and fuel it with LOX hydrogen from lunar water. However, few address the maintenance for a lunar shuttle. Have you heard of anyone addressing this issue?
Yeah, we addressed it in our paper a little bit, the paper Tony Lavoie and I wrote in 2011. And we recognize that you're going to have to worry about that problem. And one of the things we talked about was making the lunar lander both reusable and modular. And one way to solve the maintenance problem is to be able to change out the engine. And so we had included that as a design feature for our reusable lunar lander. And that's one aspect of maintenance, but we did worry about that, and we recognize that that is largely an unsolved problem. But I acknowledge that is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Do you think we're going to do much over the next 2 years, or is it really just wait and see for the next administration?
I suspect that we're not going to be doing much over the next 2 years. You'll hear a lot about how we're on track for Mars or we're on track for the asteroid, the ARM mission, but don't believe it.
Do we have any serious competition coming from another national space agency breathing down our necks, wanting to go to the moon? Is it all rhetoric? They don't have money. They don't have capability. Listeners, hi, welcome back. We have Paul back on the phone. My question was, Paul, do you think we have any serious foreign competition breathing down our back with return to the moon? A lot of them talk about it. They say it's a policy. Do they have the technical capability? Do they have the financing behind them? Or should we be concerned?
Yeah, I think that certainly the Chinese are very serious about this, and they're going to the moon. There's no doubt in my mind. And they have the capability, they have the technology, and they have the will to do it. So there's just no doubt that they're going to do it. The other possibility is the Europeans also have plans to go to the moon. In fact, they just released a video today that sort of describes the value of going back to the moon. And they have always been interested in this. When NASA abandoned their lunar program, the Europeans picked up the banner. And so they have never abrogated their desire to go to the moon and to do all the things we've talked about. So the Russians have also talked about it. That's a little more problematic. I'm never quite sure how seriously to take them and what they say. But at the same time, they certainly have the technology to do it. I don't know whether they have the economic power to pull it off or not.
Let's summarize up our program today. We're nearly 2 hours, and we have too many of my losing the connection for some reason. What do you think our important takeaway should be from your discussion today, or what would you like us to hold on to, or your pearls of wisdom?
Well, I thanks again for having me. I always enjoy my appearance here. We talked a little bit about the nature of science and how it's done, and people should be skeptical of scientific claims until they have it documented for them where the claims are coming from and what the basis is and how seriously to take that basis. We also talked about the ARM mission and what some of its problems were, how it came about, and why it took the configuration that it did. I expressed my opinion that I think it's not a real mission in the sense that it's not likely to ever actually be conducted. But again, that's my opinion. I could be wrong on that. My sense is that more and more people are realizing there's very little value. And then we talked a little bit about various aspects of returning to the moon, which, of course, I am in favor of.
As are many of our listeners, although many of our listeners are also thinking that it's worthless to go back to the moon and we should just go to Mars or maybe Deimos instead of Mars and eventually go to Mars.
Well, I've made the case before on my blog, and I believe this, that I don't think a trip directly to Mars is possible. It's not possible fiscally, and it's not possible politically. And it's barely possible technically. So I just think it's a bridge too far. I think we need to learn to walk before we run, and we're not going to Mars anytime soon, that's for sure.
How much of what we learned going to the moon with Apollo do we have to relearn today?
Quite a bit of it, simply because that generation is gone and a lot of the practical lessons of lunar exploration are lost, and the people that are alive today have never been to the moon. They've never really been beyond Leo, and they're going to have to relearn how to do all that stuff.
Well, don't they have it all written down? Don't they
it's
the blueprints?
I mean, it's written down, but how would you like to have heart surgery from a guy who learned it by reading?
Listeners, we're back, and those of you on archives won't be able to tell that we did this because I'll get rid of all the dead airtime. But those of you listening live, what the heck is happening? And I'll also bleep out my bad language. So anyway, I ask you, isn't it all written down? And don't they know how they did it? Don't they have the blueprints and the plans and what they did?
Yeah, and I was just making the point that it's written down, but practical experience is needed. And you can't really get a real feel for how to conduct these missions and make everything work together as a system of systems unless you've done it yourself for real. And the analogy I was making is, how would you like to have heart surgery by a doctor who had read about heart surgery and never done one?
Hey, that may be what's coming, so don't
well, then I guess we'll find out how reading what's written down works.
That's right. Don't knock it. And screwing around with the phone lines has given people more time to email in, so you got one more email, and listeners,
it's fine because you'll probably lose me before I get a chance to answer it anyway.
And I am not going to take any more emails after I read this one. So this is Dr. Tim Rasmus Kiel, who is a staff neuropathologist at the University Health Network Laboratory Medicine Program in Toronto, at the University of Toronto. So, and he frequently sends things into the show and communicates with me. He did try to call, but whatever, it didn't work. Two-part question regarding mining on the moon. I am just looking at a paper from your website presented at AIAA Space 2011 conference titled "Using the Resources of the Moon to Create a Permanent Cislunar Space Faring System." Page 5 shows craters on the north pole of the moon. It looks like there are relatively few but large craters, many of them 5 kilometers in size. I wonder if the ice is only present in these large, deep craters, or if it is also in smaller craters, which are larger in number. Here is how this might matter. I have an idea for how to mine ice on the lunar pole. We probably have to approach mining on the moon in many ways differently from Earth. Rather than scoop it up, perhaps we have to cover an entire crater with a sheet of metallicized plastic foil like Mylar, then cover the edges of the foil with regolith. The crater could no longer reject heat to space, so it may slowly heat up. The ice would start to sublimate. A compressor placed inside the crater could condense the water vapor.
The answer to the question, the first part, is there water in the small craters? We think there might be. There's no physical reason why water would not be stable there if the temperatures are cold enough for water to be stable. And that temperature is 104 Kelvin. So anything that's colder than 104 Kelvin will potentially can have water at the surface permanently stable. Now, we think that some of those smaller craters do contain water ice, but the fact is the distribution and the actual extent and purity and concentration of the ice is unknown for virtually every part of the pole. All we have are some vague notions. So we really need ground truth to fully understand this problem. Now, as to your second point about mining the ice, We are actually thinking about a variety of different ways about that. In the paper you cite, I just assumed we'd bulldoze it up and collect it and heat it and extract the water. That's the simplest operationally. But it's certainly true that if you could find a way to extract the water without moving the dirt, that would be enormously helpful in terms of producing more product with less waste, and you would be much more productive. So that's a good idea. It's certainly something worth looking at, and I think it's that we just need more information on the state of the ice before we can actually design a system to do something like that.
Is ice on the moon equivalent to ice here on Earth?
Nobody knows that question, and opinions vary. My opinion is that it's not, that it's a fluffy aggregate deposit of amorphous particles, which is different than dense crystalline ice. I happen to think that it tends to be low density. It tends to be distributed in a fluffy fairy castle kind of structure, because that's typically what you get in astrophysical processes.
Interesting. So you couldn't stick it in your drink and cool your bourbon down with it?
I don't think you could, but I think you could make it into a form where you could cool your bourbon down. And that's all that counts, right?
I guess so. I'm assuming we don't really know what bourbon would do in microgravity, right?
Well, if you really wanted to cool your bourbon down, you could put it in one of these cold traps and it'll cool down real quick.
But that still doesn't answer the question to what happens to you when you drink it in a lunar environment.
Well, that sounds like an important research topic.
I agree. I bet the NSF finances it for the tune of $1 billion. Wait and see. That'll be one way to get us back to the moon.
Right.
Paul, I want to thank you very much for being with us and putting up with all the telephone shenanigans today. And let's hope the next time you're on, we are on our way back to the moon. But I don't know if we can wait that long to bring you back.
Well, I, as usual, enjoyed my visit. And even with the phone problems, we always have a good discussion.
Absolutely. And listeners, again, if you're not subscribed to and reading his blog posts on a regular basis, you're missing out on something. And they're great. And I enjoy them, and I bring him on the show with a lot of what he has to say. It's very important. So thank you again, Paul, and we will stay in touch, and I'll talk to you later in the year.
Thank you much.
Listeners, that's it. Tomorrow night, regular Tuesday Space Show program, phone lines notwithstanding, and hope all of you are with us. Thank you all for joining us today, and goodbye from Dr. Spoutis and the Space Show.